Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So in today's episode, I'm going to be reacting to a speech from the Prime Minister of Canada, Mark Carney, that he gave at the World Economic Forum on January 20th, 2026. So why am I doing that? Well, I think it encapsulates a lot of things that are happening at the collective scale from not only the political aspects, but economic aspects. But there are correspondences to different things that are happening within the technology sphere. He does make some comments around artificial intelligence and refers to them as the hegemons and hyperscalers. And so there's some broader context as to what does that mean for what I perceive to be as a democratic backsliding and move towards authoritarianism in the United States, and how Canada has been on the front line of reacting to it. But there are these new coalitions that are building around the world that are going to influence what happens in the technology industry, especially if these other countries start to untether themselves from American technology companies. And I'm already starting to see some early indications of that, especially as Meta is shutting down their enterprise offerings. That's a catalyst, but there's broader discussions that are already happening from people wanting to reclaim their sovereignty away from their reliance upon US technology companies. With this democratic backsliding that's happening, I think Americans themselves are thinking about, how do I untether myself from this AI surveillance state with all this information that we've been feeding into these companies in the context of surveillance capitalism? That information has always, according to the third-party doctrine of the Fourth Amendment, have no reasonable expectation to remain private. That means that the government could always have access to all that data without a warrant to do all sorts of surveillance state stuff. So we're basically slowly devolving into an AI Big Brother type of situation. And people from around the world are recognizing that. And I think this speech from Prime Minister Carney is naming what's happening very clearly. Part of the reason why I wanted to cover this as a standalone episode is that I find myself wanting to refer to it. There's a lot of larger political metaphors that also are speaking to kind of the zeitgeist of the moment that I think are rippling out through all dimensions of society through this archetypal complex of the boundaries that we used to have, the rule of law, and how that rule of law is being dissolved into this new reality where we have to negotiate. How do you navigate a world where you're not following the same rules as you used to? And I think this speech from Prime Minister Carney is laying out how Canada is approaching this dilemma. But also, as you're listening to this, you can think about your own relationship to these technology companies and perhaps moving away from the walled garden mindset that we've had in terms of technology being in all these integrated systems and into more sovereign, open source, decentralized types of communication platforms and systems that are not reliant upon these centralized systems of networked communication. As time goes on, there's going to continue to be things that Carney is talking about here that is continuing to collapse the boundaries between these political discussions and what's happening with our technology. And that, in a lot of ways, Canada has been at the forefront of a lot of those different battles, having aspects of economic integration being weaponized against them. And so they were on the first line of defense of trying to untether themselves from associating from the United States. And so that's the deeper context for the speech that Mark Carney gave. And when I listened to it, it just really hit me to the core because it was collapsing all these things that I've been feeling, both what it means to be living here in the United States as a citizen and watching all the news and everything that's happening here, but also the connections that are tying together what's happening in the technology sphere and these other patterns that I'm seeing. This beginning of a new immersive cycle is a talk that I gave on December 18th, trying to unpack what I was starting to see in terms of this new immersive cycle that we're going into. And I think as we are thinking about the dissolution of the existing order, we're kind of moving into a new order. And we're seeing that both with AI that's dissolving all of our boundaries of what it means to be human, how we're like navigating that. We're seeing that with privacy and what's happening with our data and how could that data start to be used against us. And we're starting to see that in the political sphere in terms of these new coalitions and new trade partners, new things that are happening between these different countries. The middle powers is what Canada self-identifies as. And as those middle powers build new coalitions, then they're going to be maintaining a commitment to human rights and dignity and things that, when I went to United XR, a lot of the things that the EU is thinking about in terms of their relationship to technology technology is all based upon these human rights as a baseline. And from there, they're grounding all of their privacy law, like GDPR, with antitrust laws and these markets and the impact of these digital platforms pushing forth monopolistic and anti-competitive behaviors, they're really pushing back against that. And so in that context, you're also starting to see these tech billionaires like Elon Musk calling for the abolition of the EU because they're pushing back against some of his harm that's coming from the X platform. So anyway, I feel like that the speech from Carney really encapsulates so much, and I'm excited to dive in and start to unpack it. And so in this episode, I'm going to be playing excerpts from the speech from Prime Minister Carney of Canada, and I'll be making commentary as I go along. And there'll be maybe one or two sections that I skip, but for the most part, I'll be reacting to a lot of the different things that he's saying, because there are these connections that are coming back to what's happening within the larger technology sphere. So this lecture from Prime Minister Carney happened on Tuesday, January 20th, 2026. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
It seems that every day we're reminded that we live in an era of great power rivalry, that the rules-based order is fading, that the strong can do what they can and the weak must suffer what they must.
I just want to jump in here and say, you know, Carney is obviously talking specifically around the United States, but I think there's other ways in which that these big tech companies have also similarly been acting in a way that has been using their power to dominate different industries. I think Meta in particular, within the context of the XR industry, has being such a big player that no one is really able to publicly critique or comment on some of the shenanigans that have been happening behind the scenes since they've really become the dominant player within the XR industry, because it would be detrimental to their career. So in a similar way, I think the same thing has been happening with the United States. And so in this lecture, Carney's starting to really speak out against that. So just make that connection as you continue to listen along.
And this aphorism of Thucydides is presented as inevitable, as the natural logic of international relations reasserting itself. And faced with this logic, there is a strong tendency for countries to go along to get along, to accommodate, to avoid trouble, to hope that compliance will buy safety. Well, it won't.
Okay, so Carney, throughout the course of this speech, is talking around how do you react to this type of authoritarian turn that's happening within the United States. And I think people individually are also asking the same question of how can you untether from these relationships we have with big tech that has these aspects that are toxic and that we want to maintain our own sovereignty. And so there's a really brilliant anecdote and metaphor that he starts to give in this next section here, where it reminds me a lot of the Timothy Snyder On Tyranny book, where he's basically saying, here are the steps that you need to fight against this type of authoritarian turns, and one of which is to not obey it in advance, and also to speak the truth as to what's happening in our reality right now. And so I'm just going to play this story because I feel like it encapsulates so much of this deeper spirit to stand up to these authoritarian impulses.
In 1978, the Czech dissident Václav Havel, later president, wrote an essay called The Power of the Powerless. And in it, he asked a simple question: how did the communist system sustain itself? And his answer began with a greengrocer. Every morning, this shopkeeper places a sign in his window: workers of the world unite. He doesn't believe it. No one does. But he places the sign anyway to avoid trouble, to signal compliance, to get along. And because every shopkeeper on every street does the same, the system persists. Not through violence alone, but through the participation of ordinary people in rituals they privately know to be false. Havel called this living within a lie. The system's power comes not from its truth, but from everyone's willingness to perform as if it were true. And its fragility comes from the same source. When even one person stops performing, when the greengrocer removes his sign, the illusion begins to crack. Friends, it is time for companies and countries to take their signs down. Four decades.
Whew. Wow. Yeah. This metaphor of taking your sign down is something that really hit me when I first heard this and still sticks with me. This phrase of taking your sign down, what's that mean? For me, there is already a tendency to obey in advance and to keep quiet, or otherwise you're going to be put onto a list and be threatened. And I feel this free speech chilling effect of even just speaking out. Also, similarly, for the XR industry, I think a lot of people have had their sign out that Meta is doing a lot of good for the XR industry. And I think undeniably they have, but they've also had this dual agenda where they've had this priority of their first party apps where they subsidize the hardware. So they artificially lower the price of everything. They put everyone else that can't really compete. And then they put on top of everything, their own first party apps. And then if you weren't serving their first party apps, then they were not really doing their best to support the ecosystem. So they would do all these conflict of interest things where they would undermine the ecosystem in order to advance their own agenda. But over time that got to the point where they were doing all these shenanigans that were disruptive in a way that wasn't allowing the ecosystem to grow organically or naturally. So as they take a step back from the larger ecosystem, this new cycle is going to allow the larger industry to kind of start from a place of being able to grow from an organic place rather than from all these kind of shenanigans they've been doing. I think another sign that we've all silently had into place is that we've been okay with this type of surveillance capitalism because we get lots of cool technology things for free in a way that allows us to feel connected. But as those tools of integration are being fed into these companies, not only feeding the AI to entrench their powers, but also fed into a big authoritarian machine and creating a threat for ourselves for how do we maintain our sovereignty in the context of being integrated so seamlessly with all these companies that are trying to surveil us and track us. So that's another sign that I feel like as he's talking about all this, naming the truth of what's happening with that and also the implications of that, where we had this metaphor in our mind that this was in a private safe and it was okay because, you know, we aren't threatened personally by it. But the way that data could be weaponized against the larger populace is also something that, you know, Shoshana Zuboff has written in The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, but it's going to be worth re-looking at that, understanding what is happening with data that is being given over to these companies and where is it going. But I think, again, the sign of this authoritarian turn within the United States is the larger context that Carney's talking about.
For decades, countries like Canada prospered under what we called the rules-based international order. We joined its institutions, we praised its principles, we benefited from its predictability. And because of that, we could pursue values-based foreign policies under its protection. We knew the story of the international rules-based order was partially false, that the strongest would exempt themselves when convenient, that trade rules were enforced asymmetrically. And we knew that international law applied with varying rigor depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. This fiction was useful. And American hegemony in particular helped provide public goods, open sea lanes, a stable financial system, collective security, and support for frameworks for resolving disputes. So we placed the sign in the window. We participated in the rituals. And we largely avoided calling out the gaps between rhetoric and reality. This bargain no longer works.
So Carney is talking about this disillusion of rules-based order. And there are certain international agreements, free trade agreements, and contracts that are made from the United States internationally. And so one of the places we're starting to see this dissolution of the rule of law is that these agreements that we've agreed to are basically being broken in a way that countries are starting to push back. But also you have, for the longest time, these are selectively enforced rules-based order that's always been sort of a lie. But it's been convenient for countries to go along with that lie. And there's always been this gap between the rhetoric and the actual behaviors. And it was also convenient to go along to get along. But again, I think people are taking down their metaphorical signs and they're starting to speak the truth as to what's actually happening. But this gap between the rhetoric and actions is something that I also see happening in the big tech companies around what they say they're doing, what they're actually doing, and what's actually the impact of that. So in the context of this existing rules-based order that's completely dissolving, what's happening? What's the reaction? And so let's listen to Prime Minister Carney again.
Let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition. Over the past two decades, a series of crises in finance, health, energy, and geopolitics have laid bare the risks of extreme global integration. But more recently, great powers have begun using economic integration as weapons. Tariffs as leverage. Financial infrastructure as coercion. Supply chains as vulnerabilities to be exploited. You cannot live within the lie of mutual benefit through integration when integration becomes the source of your subordination.
Let's listen to that last line again.
You cannot live within the lie of mutual benefit through integration when integration becomes the source of your subordination.
So that economic integration that is supposed to be connective is being flipped and being used as a tool for subordination and control. And so there's a weaponization of these relationships that's happening right now in this international sphere. And I think in reaction to that, technology companies that are based in the United States are going to be impacted by this. I expect to see this dissociation that's happening from the United States on this political sphere to eventually ripple down into the technology companies that are based here, because this technological integration being used as a tool for subordination has already been happening on the third-party doctrine, having information that's being fed into U.S. intelligence agencies. There's been litigation called the Shrims litigation that, if I read from the ACLU back from August 20th, 2018, they say an Irish court ruled that U.S. surveillance programs result in the mass indiscriminate processing of Europeans' private data, and it expressed serious concerns about the lack of legal remedies for the surveillance. If the European Union's highest courts agrees, it may limit the ability of companies to easily move data from EU into the U.S. In other words, NSA spying could have a major impact on the profits of Facebook and other Silicon Valley giants. So there's been historical battles around what happens to the data and favorable rulings in terms of the Shrims litigation that may continue to kind of ripple out as people try to both have the legal frameworks that are trying to protect it. But if we can't rely upon the rule of law anymore, then we're in this new era where people are going to have to find new ways of protecting themselves. And I think one of those ways might be to just completely disconnect themselves from U.S.-based technology companies.
The multilateral institutions on which the middle powers have relied, the WTO, the UN, the COP, the architecture, the very architecture of collective problem solving, are under threat. And as a result, many countries are drawing the same conclusions, that they must develop greater strategic autonomy in energy, food, critical minerals, in finance, and supply chains.
So again, I think this move towards national sovereignty away from this globalized economic integration as a sort of resilience towards these types of erratic behaviors based upon whoever has the most power, them throwing around their power to do whatever they want. But once you sort of bend your knee to an authoritarian, you'll never unbend your knee. They will always be pushing the line because it's not based upon any sort of logic or laws or agreements, because it's all about what that powerful entity wants. And so these countries are being like, nope, we're out. We're going to form our own coalitions, our own communities, our own sovereignty. We're going to disconnect from all these tools of integration that are now being used to subordinate us. No thanks, we're out. We're going to form our own alliances. And so there's this kind of rupture that's happening right now that's going to be rippling out and have all sorts of different effects on the long term. And we're still at the very beginnings of this, but I wanted to just connect the dots between what Prime Minister Carney is saying and how each of us kind of reevaluating our relationship to big tech and moving towards these ways of reclaiming our own sovereignty and our own ability to have these decentralized peer-to-peer types of networks and communication channels going beyond some of these existing centralized communication systems. Okay, let's continue.
And this impulse is understandable. A country that can't feed itself, fuel itself, or defend itself has few options. When the rules no longer protect you, you must protect yourself.
Oof. Yeah, so I'm really feeling that. When the rules no longer protect you, you must protect yourself. And so in the context of Canada, they're doing all these things, and he's going to be talking around the things that they're doing in order to protect themselves, but also as individuals, as we evaluate our own relationship to these networks of technology, then how can we also protect ourselves?
But let's be clear-eyed about where this leads. A world of fortresses will be poorer, more fragile, and less sustainable. And there's another truth. If great powers abandon even the pretense of rules and values for the unhindered pursuit of their power and interests, the gains from transactionalism will become harder to replicate.
So it sounds like Carney is laying out a dilemma here where this kind of economic integration has built a sort of resilience globally for everybody is benefiting to some extent. Although when I say everybody, there's certainly been exploitation and there's a bit of a hierarchy of who is benefiting and who may not be benefiting as much. And so there's a economic idea of preferential attachment, which means that the rich get richer, essentially, that once you have enough wealth and you continue to act in a way that is consolidating that wealth, then you continue to aggregate that wealth over time, compounding interest, all these dynamics that the rich end up getting richer. And so there's this paradox of, yes, the economic tools of integration can be beneficial for a lot of people, but yet if you just kind of let the authoritarians do what they want and everybody's bending their knee to them, then they're just going to kind of entrench their power and have every interaction they're doing be monetized, but in a way that's no longer an actual relationship. It's a transactional relationship. And so Carney says,
hegemons cannot continually monetize their relationships. Allies will diversify to hedge against uncertainty. They'll buy insurance, increase options in order to rebuild sovereignty. Sovereignty that was once grounded in rules but will increasingly be anchored in the ability to withstand pressure.
Wow. So if we can't rely upon rules, then we need to find systems to protect ourselves from sustaining that type of pressure. I feel like I'm feeling that myself. And from this geopolitical context, then middle power countries like Canada are refusing to go along with this game of backroom deals that are going to reduce tariffs and like basically things that are off the books and not what agreements have happened, but based upon the very ephemeral motions of a powerful authoritarian, they're no longer wanting to negotiate in that way and be on the wrong side of that power asymmetry. And so they're going to diversify. They're going to build new coalitions and basically cooperate together to create this counteracting force to this type of authoritarian lack of rules-based order. So if we don't have that rules-based order, then there's an ability for these countries to withstand pressure based upon their relationships and coalitions that they're building. And so similarly, how do you withstand the pressure of this democratic backsliding and authoritarian turn? It could be that you're moving more towards companies that are not taking your data, not feeding into AI big brother machines, that you're moving towards more open source systems, decentralized peer-to-peer, that you can disassociate yourself from these larger mechanisms of control into systems that may actually be protecting different aspects of your sovereignty that are under threat. And so the same type of discussions that Carney's talking about, I think we all are negotiating with. How do we navigate the systems of technological integration in a way that we can preserve and maintain our own sovereignty?
This room knows this is classic risk management. Risk management comes at a price. But that cost of strategic autonomy, of sovereignty, can also be shared. Collective investments in resilience are cheaper than everyone building their own fortresses. Shared standards reduce fragmentations. Complementarities are positive sum. And the question for middle powers like Canada is not whether to adapt to the new reality, we must. The question is whether we adapt by simply building higher walls or whether we can do something more ambitious.
This idea of collective investment and sovereignty harkens back to technology metaphors, open source, open standards, other ways that there can be these alternatives to these different systems. And Carney's essentially proposing that there's a new coalition. Like, can these middle powers do something more than just building their own nationalistic walls? Can they combine in a way with shared principles and shared values in a way that maintains principles of human rights and basically the same things that are happening within the context of the EU? And so there seems to be a larger movement of a new world order that may be emerging out of this through the coalition of lots of smaller middle power countries that are combining their power in a way that is a countervailing force to this authoritarian turn we're seeing in the United States. Okay, let's continue.
Now, Canada was amongst the first to hear the wake-up call, leading us to fundamentally shift our strategic posture. Canadians know that our old comfortable assumptions that our geography and alliance memberships automatically conferred prosperity and security, that assumption is no longer valid. And our new approach rests on what Alexander Stubb, the president of Finland, has termed value-based realism, Or to put another way, we aim to be both principled and pragmatic.
So Canada has really been on the front lines of dealing with this authoritarian turn from the United States, and they've just pushed back. So with the tariffs and everything else, the citizens of Canada have had all these boycotts of United States products, even some larger cultural movements to discourage people from even coming from the United States and not really engaged in any fashion and just cut off that relationship. And so a lot of this weaponization of the economic integration has resulted in this backlash where people are like, all right, well, we're just going to never buy any other American products ever again. And you have all these whiskey companies going out of business. And so you basically have this blowback from tariffs, but also really getting down to what are the values that Canada is trying to embody and have this pragmatic approach where they maybe have coalitions with people that aren't always agreed with those values, but at the core, going back to these core values and seeing that the United States isn't embodying those values anymore. So they're basically cutting off their relationship with the United States to the best they can. So he talks a little bit more around what those values are.
Principled in our commitment to fundamental values, sovereignty, territorial integrity, the prohibition of the use of force except when consistent with the UN Charter, and respect for human rights.
This question of human rights, I think, is coming up in the context of larger question around what is a technology policy that's based upon human rights? What is an approach to privacy that is based upon human rights? That's essentially what the GDPR has done, but the United States have this kind of patchwork legislation around privacy. But Canada and European Union are moving towards these more human rights focused regulations and constraints around the technology companies that, again, those technology companies are pushing back in different ways that have folks like Elon Musk calling for the abolition of the European Union. And again, it gets back to that they're trying to protect the dignity and human rights of everybody. And when I went to United XR, there was a lot of discussions around this types of human rights approach and dignity towards our technology. And so there's this disconnect between the American values and what's coming up for the technology companies themselves. And rights to due process is something that's being abandoned here in the United States. And so there's ways in which this human rights emphasis is being ignored. And to me, that's horrifying, the implications of that, because once that's ignored, then where does this go here in the future? This is a topic that came up in a conversation I had with a war photographer named Karim Ben Khalifa, who was reflecting on what kind of world do we live in when we abandon fundamental things like human rights. But other countries around the world, specifically EU and Canada, are moving more towards this human rights-centered values.
And pragmatic in recognizing that progress is often incremental, that interests diverge, that not every partner will share all of our values. So we're engaging broadly, strategically, with open eyes. We actively take on the world as it is, not wait around for a world we wish to be.
I think this sort of pragmatism is also, everyone has to weigh their ideals to what we would like to have a relationship to these big tech companies and these integrations, and what's pragmatic for what you can and cannot live without. Like, there's going to be a number of different things as people evaluate for yourself. How can I start to untether myself from these technology companies? There'll be pragmatic decisions where you won't be able to live into your ultimate ideals. And I think that's a similar thing that Canada is going through, but also is a deeper process that everyone is also thinking about as well.
We are calibrating our relationships so their depth reflects our values. And we're prioritizing broad engagement to maximize our influence. And given the fluidity of the world at the moment, the risks that this poses and the stakes for what comes next. And we are no longer just relying on the strength of our values, but also the value of our strength. We are building that strength at home.
Okay, so basically Prime Minister Carney is talking about there's these new coalitions that they're building based upon values, but also pragmatism. And so they're embodying those values in their new relationships they're cultivating, but they're also doing a bunch of stuff at home in terms of their different policies. I'm going to skip some sections here and you can go listen to the full speech if you want to hear some of the stuff that he's going into. I want to jump forward to a section where he starts to talk around AI, and I wanted to unpack some of the specific things that he says here. So let's hear what he's saying around their vision of AI.
And on AI, we're cooperating with like-minded democracies to ensure that we won't ultimately be forced to choose between hegemons and hyperscalers.
So the hegemons and hyperscalers, the United States is part of this larger hegemonic force, but also these big tech companies that are doing this type of data colonialism, you know, not having full consent around the data. And also this idea of hyperscaling has been an approach within the context of machine learning, where if you just throw enough GPUs and data at it, that you get enough empirical results based upon these benchmarks that are collapsing context, erasing different aspects of things that humans could do in terms of relationships, context, and meaning, that these AI systems are giving a proxy of what's happening, but aren't really fully integrating that. And so anyway, there's this debate within the larger AI research community that when I went to the International Joint Conference of Artificial Intelligence, you know, the way that I started to think about it was this bottom-up data-driven approach with machine learning, where you throw a bunch of data at it and then you see how it does, versus a more top-down symbolic AI or neuro-symbolic architectures that are trying to be more formalized in the reasoned knowledge management relationships that they're forming. And so you have this dialectic between the bottom up and the top down, and different systems like AlphaGo was a combination of these two different types of approaches in 2016. But we've kind of had this turn towards this more bottom up machine driven approach. And so I wanted to read a couple of quotes from Karen Howes, The Empire of AI, because I think she really is identifying some key concepts for what is happening in AI that gives a broader sociopolitical context to it. And so Karen Howe is talking around this debate and dialectic between the bottom-up approach and top-down approach. And so she calls the bottom-up machine learning approach connectivism and the top-down approach symbolic AI. And so she says there's a new way of looking at the kind of history of the evolution of these AI technologies. And she says, quote, "Connectionism rose to overshadow symbolism, not just for its scientific merit. It also won over the backing of deep-pocketed funders due to key advantages that appealed to those funders' business interests." She says, "The strength of symbolic AI is the explicit encoding information in the relationships into the system and allowing it to retrieve accurate answers and perform reasoning, a feature of the human intelligence seen as critical to its replication." And so she talks around IBM Watson as the paradigmatic example of this more top-down symbolic approach. But she says the weakness of symbolism, on the other hand, has been to its detriment. Time and time again, its commercialization has proven slow, expensive, and unpredictable. So when you can like predict by throwing more GPUs at something that you're going to get marginally increased empirical results based upon whatever benchmark you're looking at, then it tends to have more economic power and it's less unpredictable as the symbolic AI approach. And so we've been fed a form of AI through large language models that increase with the numbers of GPUs and money and data that you throw at it. And so this is what Karen Howe says. Neural networks, meanwhile, come with a different trade-off. For years, the field has aggressively debated whether such connectionist software can do what symbolic ones can, store information and reason. And so there's obviously a lot of debate around whether or not these things are actually reasoning. A lot of people from the AI researchers are saying that it's not reasoning, but people will see the implications that it's doing sort of reasoning. So people, you know, think it's doing reasoning. So there's active debate around that. And she says, regardless of the answer of whether or not they're actually storing information and reasoning, is it become clear that if they can, they do so inefficiently. Only with extraordinary amounts of data and computational power have neural networks even begun to have the kinds of behaviors that may suggest the emergence of either property. And she continues by saying, that said, one area where deep learning models really shine is how easily it is to commercialize them. You do not need perfectly accurate systems with reasoning capabilities to turn a handsome profit. Strong statistical pattern matching and prediction go a long way in solving financially lucrative problems. The path to reaping a return, despite similarly expensive upfront investment, is also short and predictable, well-suited to corporate planning cycles and the pace of quarterly earnings. Even better, that such models can be spun up for a range of contexts without specialized domain knowledge. Fitting for a tech giant's expansive ambitions, not to mention that deep learning affords the greatest competitive advantage to players with the most data. So you have this larger economic context for the design tracks for where AI is going, that is this machine learning driven, deep learning, throw a bunch of GPUs, scale is all you need, and then all the surveillance capitalism data that you're gathering, you're throwing that at that as well in order to train up all these different models. And so there's a post by Gary Marcus he did on a Substack on December 8, 2025 called "Scale is All You Need is Dead," where he has from a long time been pushing back against this kind of idea that if you just throw GPUs and scale at these problems that you'll have infinite growth forever. But from all these different various benchmarks that they're using to evaluate their own models, which we don't have transparency. We don't know like how accurate those benchmarks are. There's a lot of problems with that, that if you want to dig into, you can listen to my conversation with Emily Embender and Alex Hanna in the AI Con episode where we deconstruct this kind of benchmark driven approach. But regardless of that, even by their own standards, it's plateauing in terms of what capabilities they have. And so given that, there's kind of a limit to the scale is all you need. And so there may be at some point a popping of the bubble because you can no longer just throw more scale and money at the problem. It's going to have all these different hallucinations and these deep intractable problems that we have with large language models may at some point implode. But we're at this point where these technology companies are seeing that, you know, with the iPhone, that was the last big major technology platform shift, that they kind of sense that we're on the cusp of another platform shift. We're at the beginning of a new immersive cycle. And so there's this over investment in all these GPUs and RAM. And there's like these global shortages of RAM because there's basically none of the different big technology companies want to be left behind for missing the boat of not having enough compute power to drive the latest AI innovations. That's going to be the so-called future of compute technology, which this current large language model scales all you need approach is going to inevitably pop. It's similar to bubbles popping before with what happened with the dot-com bubble. We had the dot-com bubble because there was an overzealous investment in different technologies that were being overpromised for in the short term. In the long term, obviously, the internet's still around. The World Wide Web never went away, but similarly, AI, I think, is going to be persistent, but we're in this peak of a hype cycle where everyone's sort of deluded as to what's actually happening. And the end result is that we have shortages of RAM. Valve isn't like shipping their headset out. And so we have this mad rush to get all the compute data because you don't want to miss the boat of this speculative AI thing that kind of sucks and that is a horrible experience for a lot of people and that is dehumanizing. And there's a way in which that they're equating the labor of these large language models with human labor. And so people are getting fired, losing their jobs. And there's just a lot of like discussion around like, what does it even mean to be human is a deeper context to these conversations. Anyway, I think this phrase of hegemons and hyperscalers that Mark Carney is mentioning is kind of also a bit of a pushback towards that. Like, can we do this in a way that doesn't require a huge amount of investment into these compute technologies? Are there other ways to be more efficient, better algorithms, maybe go slower, but have something that isn't going to be using these tools of integration technologically to be tools of subordination in different ways? So again, finding that sovereignty and finding different approaches for how they're approaching AI. So that phrase of the hegemons and the hyperscalers, just want to kind of unpack and dig into the deeper context of that. Okay, let's go back to Carney.
This is not naive multilateralism, nor is it relying on their institutions. It's building coalitions that work, issues by issue, with partners who share enough common ground to act together. In some cases, this will be the vast majority of nations. What it's doing is creating a dense web of connections across trade, investment, culture, on which we can draw for future challenges and opportunities. I argue the middle powers must act together because if we're not at the table, we're on the menu.
Whew. If we're not at the table, we're on the menu. It reminds me of the quote that if you're not paying for the product, you are the product. And so there's a lot of ways in which that these tech companies have been treating us as if we are on the menu to be served up all of our data and to be sold to others. That's essentially what's happening with surveillance capitalism. Shoshana Zuboff, you know, the book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, was so prescient in naming all of this. But again, because of the benefits of the technological integration that we've had in our lives, we've turned a blind eye to that. But I'm saying now that it might be time to be taking down some of those signs. So if you're not at the table, you're on the menu, is the point Carney's making, in that he's saying that around Canada and these middle power countries, that if they're not at the table having discussions around these decisions that have power implications, then they're on the menu to be consumed. And I think similarly, we are on the menu if we're not at the table of deciding what happens to our own data.
But I'd also say that great powers can afford for now to go it alone. They have the market size, the military capacity, and the leverage to dictate terms. Middle powers do not. But when we only negotiate bilaterally with a hegemon, we negotiate from weakness. We accept what's offered. We compete with each other to be the most accommodating. This is not sovereignty. It's the performance of sovereignty while accepting subordination.
Oof. a performance of sovereignty while accepting subordination. So this type of performative aspect to the sovereignty where it's not actually there. And so I think there's these questions of like, how do you actually regain your sovereignty and not just do these performative rituals?
In a world of great power rivalry, the countries in between have a choice: compete with each other for favor or to combine to create a third path with impact.
So again, I think it's pointing towards this new coalitions that are developing in the global order that are trying to fight back against these turns towards this hegemonic approach. Now, as I say all of this, some criticisms of Carney was to just focus this on the United States, but folks like Sarah Kendzior were saying that, no, this is actually not a U.S.-specific problem, but that there's a global cabal of rich billionaire capitalists that are in each of these different countries, and in their own way, there are these movements towards this type of nationalism and far right, and the same type of thing that is happening in the United States could actually spread around the world. And what Canada is proposing is that we have this new idealistic cooperation that's happening with all these middle powers, and they're going to continue to preserve all these human rights and this kind of values-based approach. But it could be that everybody turns into this Machiavellian system where all of their local governments are being run by these democratic backsliding authoritarians that, you know, there's no guarantee that we're going to have democracy around the world as we have right now. We could be into an era where everybody starts to go the same path. And so no one's immune to this type of attack towards democracy. Democracy can be very brittle, especially when it hasn't necessarily been stress tested. So yeah, it's not just the United States. It's the problem of capitalism and tech billionaires having this type of regulatory capture and capture of entire governments, that these other countries around the world are not immune to that same type of attack, especially when so much of the process of democracy is everybody following the same rules. If you have people who are willing to not follow those rules and start to break those rules or change the rules so that everything that they're doing is technically legal, which is sort of what's happening in the United States with the erasure of due process based upon the Kavanaugh stops of this Supreme Court ruling that was meant to be for border agents at the border, now letting them to do that anywhere in the United States, basically have papers, please, let me see if you're legal or not type of Kavanaugh checks that are happening in the United States, erasing aspects of due process in ways that have not been able to make their way through the courts to establish a constitutional violation of due process, which is happening. We can all see it. ACLU is filing tons of lawsuits around all of this stuff, but we have this kind of lawfare that is happening over longer periods of time. So that it takes a long time to go through getting decisions, having those appealed, going up to the Supreme Court. All this stuff is like a long deliberative process where they're basically DDoSing our legal system to basically flood it and overwhelm it with all these violations of the normal rule of law. But the end result is that the normal rule of law is not being followed. Ugh, my God, what is even happening in this world? Let's go back to Carney. What's he have to say?
We shouldn't allow the rise of hard power to blind us to the fact that the power of legitimacy, integrity, and rules will remain strong if we choose to wield them together.
Whew. I get a bit emotional just even hearing that. There's a bit of hopes and dreams of, you know, the fact that the rule of law is going to maintain itself and continue, but there's no guarantee. But I think there's a collective gathering of these middle power countries that are saying, no, the rule of law is really important. Let's maintain it. But yeah, as I listen to that, it's really sad because it's like a grieving process that, you know, we're kind of losing the rule of law and United States and around the world. And it's an unsettling experience. How do you deal with that?
Which brings me back to Havel. What does it mean for middle powers to live the truth? Well, first, it means naming reality. Stop invoking rules-based international order as though it still functions as advertised. Call it what it is: a system of intensifying great power rivalry, where the most powerful pursue their interests using economic integration as coercion.
That's it. That's the answer. Name it. You just got to name it. You just got to name what's happening. Call the truth as it is. We're in a time where we have so much misinformation and disinformation and like these stories and narratives that are just not based upon the truth. But that right there, that was true. How can you create a context where you can really speak your deepest truth and feel comfortable doing that? I'm listening to Carney, and I tell you, it's the first time that really kind of hit me in the gut. It still does as I listen to it, because I know what he's saying is true. And he's standing up and he's naming it. He's taking his sign down. And people around the world are hearing the speech and also taking their sign down. And I think as a result, wanting to untether from being enmeshed.
Canada has what the world wants.
So I'm going to play out the rest of his speech. There's a few sections that I skipped over, but he's basically returning back to what's happening there in Canada and why Canada should be considered to be a partner in this new coalition that he's proposing here. So let's just finish it off and I'll give some final thoughts here at the end.
Canada is a pluralistic society that works. Our public square is loud, diverse, and free. Canadians remain committed to sustainability. We are a stable and reliable partner in a world that is anything but. A partner that builds and values relationships for the long term. And we have something else. We have a recognition of what's happening and a determination to act accordingly. We understand that this rupture calls for more than adaptation. It calls for honesty about the world as it is. We are taking the sign out of the window. We know the old order is not coming back. We shouldn't mourn it. Nostalgia is not a strategy. But we believe that from the fracture, we can build something bigger, better, stronger, more just. This is the task of the middle powers. The countries that have the most to lose from a world of fortresses and a most to gain from genuine cooperation. The powerful have their power, but we have something too. The capacity to stop pretending, to name reality, to build our strength at home, and to act together. That is Canada's path. We choose it openly and confidently, and it is a path wide open to any country willing to take it with us. Thank you very much.
Wow. That is such an incredible speech. Just because it names so much of what I'm feeling, I think the world's feeling, I think not only naming what's happening, but also a vision what's happening in a way that's really speaking to these deeper archetypal dynamics of the moment in terms of like the dissolution of the rule of law and needing to have new coalitions with people with not a lot of power on their own, cooperating and collaborating together to work together towards this larger vision. And I know the couple of times that I listened to this and he says, we shouldn't grieve the loss of the rule of law. It's hard for me not to grieve this loss of a hope and vision of an ideal of democracy. And from Canada's perspective, he's saying we need to move on. And, you know, they have their own sovereign government that they can maintain the rule of law. And I don't know what's going to happen in the United States, and I don't know where this is all going to go. Like, if we turn this boat, it's going to be like a huge need for a deep truth and reconciliation and also a naming of what's happening. And I think we're still in this space where at least half the country completely agrees with what's going on and believes everything that's happening. And then the other half is like seeing the harsh realities of that lie. So I don't know if the harsh realities of the truth are going to be able to battle against all the disinformation that's happening right now. So it's a battle of narratives that's playing out. And I think that everybody's sort of dealing with different harsh realities of life, especially in the XR industry. It's not like gangbusters right now, especially as some of the biggest players are taking a step back. There's a lot of like reevaluating, like what is the foundation that we're building on here, especially as we have these larger hardware constraints based upon hype cycles of stuff that may or may not be real in terms of AI and where is it going. And Valve has not been able to announce their timing of their headsets and their pricing because of the uncertainty of being able to source the RAM, because all the RAM is a global shortage because of the hype around AI. push forward all this AI slop that's out there. So we're at this crossroads, I think, not only in the world in terms of these new coalitions building against this type of dissolution of rule-based order into new coalitions that are values-based and human rights principles, and we'll be digging into a lot more of those concepts and ideas when on my coverage around United XR. Yeah, it's a choice point. Can we really imagine a future that we want to live into and ways that we need to cooperate and collaborate with each other? Really going back to the early days of the internet and that kind of idealism that was there, recapturing that spirit into this next phase of, can we create systems that are empowering people, that sort of autonomy and control and sovereignty? Or are we just creating more walled gardens for these tech companies to maintain this kind of monopoly power over everything that, you know, harms everybody to have this 30% tax on everything that happens on the internet because it has to be mediated through a platform? Can we have systems that are not centralizing all that money into a handful of companies, but that are actually empowering a diverse and vibrant ecosystem that goes above and beyond what has been cultivated by a handful of duopoly powers? There's an opportunity here for some creative imagination, not only within this international scale, but even in your own ecosystem, your own relationships, your own life, your own relationship to these technological integrations that could soon be used as tools of subordination. But yeah, there's a moment here for our own imagination to kind of be a countervailing force to the harsh realities of life. And so we can start to dream of futures, speculative futures that don't yet quite exist, and we can start to plant the seeds by telling those stories, writing them down, creating immersive experiences, creating pieces of art that inspire each other. Make a piece of art and give it to someone is what Flea said in The Plea. So reminding ourselves what it means to be human, not being dehumanized by AI hype that is trying to tell us that we are no better than an AI algorithm that is made up a bunch of mathematical probabilistic reasoning that has no context, meaning, or deeper value, but that we are human, we have values, emotions, meaning, purpose, relationships, and context in a way that AI does not. So we can fight for our humanity and, you know, create these visions of the future that we actually want to live into, and then build new coalitions, just like Canada has to build new coalitions. This is our opportunity to build these new coalitions. And so, yeah, thanks for taking this little journey with me. It's a little experiment. I had to get all this off my chest. I've been thinking about it. There's a discussion we had around the Ombudspersons of the Year for the Polly's Awards. And so there's some of this that in the next episode I'll probably be digging in. I was thinking about adding this in the beginning or end of the episode, but I was like, no, this really needs to be its own thing so I can point to it as something, as a reference to really just go on this journey, unpacking everything. Anyway, thanks for going on this little adventure, something new, something different, that hopefully some of the words that Carney's saying resonated with you as much as they did with me. Speaking the truth is really powerful. Naming things is powerful. So even if you can't do anything, just naming the reality as you see it is good enough. And so hopefully that's a bit of what we've been able to do here with our time together. But finding ways that you can just name the truth, and what's the sign that you need to take down in your life. So that's all I have for today. And I just wanted to thank you for listening to the Voices of VR podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a listener-supported podcast, and so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue to bring you this coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.